Here's a new way to stay connected to Issues Etc. Check out our page on Facebook. Network with fellow Issues Etc. junkies. Sign up to become a fan, and we'll send you updates on future topics and guests. You'll even find photos of in-studio guests, Todd drinking gelato, and highlights from our one-year anniversary open house. You'll discover that Todd, Jeff, and Craig really do have faces for radio on Facebook. Issues Etc. on Facebook. Another way to stay connected to Issues Etc. Facebook.com/IssuesETC.
My generation was really doing something very special, which then went into the marches on Washington and so many other things that bonded us together. We felt we could do anything. We could change the world, and that's what it was all about.
And then, you know, Jimi Hendrix, his rendition of the national anthem and sort of summing up our lives for that, you know, at that moment, and then it was over, and how everybody came together in this amazing family, you know, this amazing sort of community that was formed.
That's Barbara Koppel, a documentary filmmaker, and Michael Lang, famous organizer of Woodstock, a rock and roll festival 40 years ago that many believe not only is a cultural icon, an icon of rock and roll, but also some believe is in fact more than that, the starting point, perhaps the kicking off point for a cultural revolution. And that's the mythology of the 1960s, isn't it? That by the time we came to the end of that decade, 1969, it was an army of people ready to change the world, family of people ready to, as they say in that old song, get back to the garden and undo everything that the establishment had done. Is that true? We're going to talk about the 40th anniversary of Woodstock with Jonathan Leaf, author of the new book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the 60s, here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. on this Wednesday, August the 19th. You can join us for the next 2 hours. I'm Todd Wilkin, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943, or you can email your questions to us right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. Terry Mattingly will join us for the second half hour of the program today. We're going to talk about several issues. The Roman Catholic Church has every reason, and faithful Roman Catholics have every reason to support health care reform. In fact, the bishops have said that some form of universal health care reform, health care for everyone, is perfectly in line with the ethic of the Catholic Church. So why is it that we have prominent Roman Catholic voices, especially in politics, championing the need for universal health care, but leaving out the other important concerns they ought to have as Catholics, like end-of-life issues and abortion issues and whether or not we pay for those things in health care reform? We'll also talk with Terry Mattingly about what the Little Episcopal Church USA, barely 2 million people and not very many people attending it, even at that, gets so much news coverage. And then we'll also talk about the coverage, or the lack thereof, of the basic life and work of Eunice Kennedy Shriver, who died recently. If you read those obituaries, you got all the facts, but they didn't come together in a way that gave you an accurate picture, really, of what Eunice Kennedy Shriver's life and concerns were really all about. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse will kick off the second hour for us. We'll be talking with her about some court papers filed Monday by the Obama administration, arguing that the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, discriminates against gays, and yet the Justice Department, because it is the law of the land since the Clinton administration, will continue to defend the law, I guess, until it's formally challenged in court. Dr. Matt Phillips will join us to remember on this day, along with the rest of the church, the 12th century theologian and hymn writer Bernard of Clairvaux. He had a rather rocky life as a theologian. And then at the end of the program here for the last half hour or so, we're going to do some audio open lines. We did some yesterday and just couldn't fit all of the email and the phone calls in. So we decided, since the churchwide assembly of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America continues today, in fact, they were scheduled to vote on the gay ordination issue. They may not be doing that until tomorrow. We thought we'd continue to hear what you have to say about the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America on the edge of approving and lifting its ban on openly gay clergy. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE, or talkback@issuesetc.org. talkback at issuesetc.org. Before we get started, I want to point you to our website. People go there every night to listen on demand. We love our on-demand listeners. To find out what we've been talking about, there's another way that you can help us by going to our website, issuesetc.org. When you get there, click promote, and you're going to find a new, one of several, but the newest of the Issues Etc. YouTube videos. What we'd like you to do is send that to 10 of your friends, 10 of your coworkers, 10 of your fellow parishioners, whoever those 10 people may be, and ask them to watch this short promotional video for Issues Etc. Let them know what it's about. It's only a little bit more than a minute long, and you can get it by going to our website, issuesetc.org, click promote, then email it to 10 of your friends. Now, make sure you tell us that you did this. Email us at talkback@issuesetc.org. Let us know that you sent this promotional video to 10 of your friends, and we'll enter your name along with the many others who have done so far for a drawing that we're going to hold Friday, the 28th of October, live on the air for a $100 gift certificate to Concordia Publishing House. So go to our website, issuesetc.org, click promote. If you haven't watched the video yourself and then send it to 10 of your friends. Email us, talkback@issuesetc.org. Let us know you did. And then tune in on the 28th, Friday, live on the air. We're going to be drawing a name of one of those who's helped us out like this for a $100 gift certificate to Concordia Publishing House. So were the 60s everything that we're told they were? In particular, this big event that was celebrated last week, Woodstock, was it the nirvana, the utopia, or the beginning of such for this generation of people who are now known as the baby boomers, who have left behind their dancing in the mud and listening to rock and roll out in the open air and camping under the stars for ordinary lives of ordinary citizens? Did it change the world? We're told that it did. Now, for someone like me, growing up as a child of the 60s, literally a child of the 60s, that is born smack dab in the middle of that generation, things like Woodstock and the terrible year of 1968 came and went without any notice on my part because I was just a little kid. But I grew up with the mythos of the 60s. I grew up with being told by my elders what this generation must have meant and how important Woodstock was. A musical revolution and a cultural revolution, a sexual revolution, and a revolution of ideas and of man's place on the planet. All of those things have been in some way or another traced back to what happened at Woodstock. Or was it just a big concert and a lot of drugs? I want to hear from you if you can remember Woodstock, or perhaps you might have been among the 500,000 there in attendance or knew someone who was. 1-877-623-6943 or talk back at issuesetc.org. Jonathan Leaf is a playwright and a cultural critic in New York City. He's written about arts and culture for National Review, The Weekly Standard, and The New Criterion, and he's author of the new book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the 60s. Jonathan, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you so much.
Was Woodstock what it is often claimed or believed to be, this beginning of a revolution of man, so to speak, in America, this revolution of ideas, culture, sex, and everything that it's often presented as?
No, I mean, it's there are two ways in which Woodstock is misrepresented. One way is that it's presented as something emblematic of the 60s, which it isn't. But a second way is it's presented, as you say, as this kind of embodiment of free love and rock and roll and drugs that's all good. And in fact, if you look at it more closely, you see that there was a lot of bad there too, but that's another story.
Okay, let's talk about the first part of that contention, that it was somehow emblematic of the 60s. It comes along at the end of the 60s and is supposed to be, I mean, at least I grew up always being told, that it was the quintessence of that decade. How is it not?
Well, most people in the 60s weren't doing lots of drugs, and most of them weren't having orgies, and most of them weren't, in fact, even listening to rock and roll. We give the example in my book, Politically Incorrect Guide to the 60s, this question. Which of the following groups or individuals had a number one Billboard top single during the 1960s? Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix, The Grateful Dead, Carlos Santana, Buffalo Springfield, Jefferson Airplane, The Who, or Bobby Vinton?
Which one is it?
Bobby Vinton. None of the others, and that includes Bob Dylan and the Grateful Dead, had a number one hit in the 60s. Bobby Vinton, the guy who sang the crooner, sang Blue Velvet, had four. If you look at album charts of the 1960s and you look at what really sold, the biggest selling album right into the 1970s was My Fair Lady, not the, anything by the Beatles or the Rolling Stones. Beatles and Rolling Stones were very big, but so was Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. So was George Jones and Loretta Lynn and Frank Sinatra and Andy Williams and Barbara Streisand. A lot of other stuff. Rock and roll really did not sell, for the most part, anywhere near the way people think. Rock and roll was not, for the most part, the big music of the 60s.
Was it merely how the youth were celebrating the 60s? There was Woodstock about America's youth and their new ideas?
Well, I don't know about new ideas. It certainly was an event. You know, it was overwhelmingly young people who went. But at the same time, even people's image of college students in the 60s is mostly false. There were more students in the 1960s who self-identified on college campuses as conservative than anything else. More students were involved with the Young Americans for Freedom, a conservative group, than the Students for Democratic Society, the so-called anti-war group that opposed the U.S. participation in the war in Vietnam. The most in-demand college speaker during the 1960s, right up in the mid-60s, was Barry Goldwater, the Republican presidential candidate, more in demand than Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr. And then if you look at 60s fashions, outside of Haight-Ashbury, most kids weren't wearing tie-dyed shirts and love beads. In fact, 60s radicals, for the most part, were 60s radicals, I'm talking about, were very conservative dressers. If you look at pictures of...
Let's take a break here. When we come back, I'm going to let you finish that thought. Jonathan Leaf is our guest. We're talking about the 40th anniversary of Woodstock.
Thanks for sending us your email. Having produced Issues Etc. for more than 15 years, I can tell you that we've never received email response like this. Unfortunately, we simply can't reply to all of your email. So here's a way that I can almost guarantee a response to your question or comment. Call the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8384. It's available for your questions or comments 24/7, 618-223-8384.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7? Check out our website, issuesetc.org, and click on-demand audio. Listen at the gym, in your kitchen, in your garden, on your iPod, your computer, or in your car. The technology may be new, but the truth never changes. Issues Etc. on-demand audio, available for your convenience at issuesetc.org. 10 hours of new programming each week, issuesetc.org, and click on-demand audio.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most radio talk shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you to pay for the production, salary, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio. The address? LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend on you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc. Thanks for your consideration. Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about the 40th anniversary of Woodstock, what it was and what it wasn't. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Jonathan Leaf is our guest, a playwright and cultural critic in New York City. He's written about arts and culture for National Review, The Weekly Standard, and The New Criterion. He's author of the new book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the 60s. Our call-in number on this Wednesday afternoon, the 19th of August, 1-877-623-6943. Our email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Before the break, you were talking about the youth of the 60s, especially Woodstock era time 60s, late 60s. And the impression, of course, is given that they were all tie-dye and political radicalism. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, it, actually, if you look at pictures of political radicals in the late 60s and at places like Harvard and Columbia and at the Pentagon March, even the political radicals, for the most part, dressed very conservatively. The boys are usually wearing blue blazers or Harris tweed jackets. They're wearing rep ties. They're wearing penny loafers. The girls typically are wearing long sleeve dresses, stockings, low heels. These are political protests. So the image that people have of how people dressed, yes, at Woodstock, there certainly were people showed up wearing kind of stereotypical Haight-Ashbury hippie fashions. But most Americans did not dress that way. Certainly most working people didn't dress that way. And many people literally never went through the entire 60s without ever meeting a hippie. So the idea that hippies are what the 60s is about is really false. But in addition, there's a second misrepresentation about Woodstock, which is that doing lots of drugs was good for everybody who did it. Now, certainly some people who went to Woodstock probably had a great time. Most of the people I've interviewed and talked to said it was raining, there were no facilities, we left, it was awful, you couldn't hear anything, or the sound was terrible. And in fact, when Jimi Hendrix got on as the last act of the festival, there weren't many people left. But even beyond that, there's the whole issue of what did drugs do to a significant number of the people who took them. Jimi Hendrix was the closing act of the festival and arguably the greatest performer. He died of a drug overdose. Janis Joplin performed there. She died of a drug overdose. The Who performed there. Their drummer and their bassist, Keith Moon and John Entwistle, died of drug overdoses. Canned Heat, the lead singer, died of a drug overdose, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the second part of the story about Woodstock that's not told, just how dangerous what the drug-taking that it involved was.
Yeah, I heard one guy interviewed on Woodstock. He said when he was there, he said, when you went to Woodstock, what was it like? What did you take away from it? He goes, dysentery. So apparently it was not all, you know, the Garden of Eden. Why are most of us led to believe then that Woodstock was the cultural icon of the 60s? Where did that mythos grow out of?
Well, Warner Brothers helped finance the concert, and then they made this movie that sold an enormous number of tickets, this concert movie, which they've come out in different editions of, and they have on MTV and so forth. But it's not just Warner Brothers. There's a whole part of the media elite in Hollywood, you know, Oliver Stone and Spike Lee and so forth, which like to present a certain image of the 60s. And that image of the 60s is really about certain kinds of personal activities, personal rebellion, drug taking, having sex with strangers, et cetera, et cetera. And they want to present this as what the 60s was all about, though it has very little to do with the life that most Americans led at the time. And, of course, they also, as with Woodstock and the drug taking, they don't want to present any of the negative stuff that came out of this.
To what degree has that image of Woodstock remained with us, not just in itself, but remained with us as kind of, some would hope an inspiration for how things can be again in the United States?
Well, the image is obviously very powerful because, you know, I've gotten letters since my book, which I'm going to shamelessly mention again, Politically Incorrect Guide to the 60s, since it came out, I've gotten letters and emails from people all over the country saying, you know, whenever the subject of the 60s came up, I would always say, you know, I didn't really participate in the 60s. I wasn't part of the 60s. Your book is the first thing that's gotten me to actually realize that, no, the life I led, you know, having two kids and living on an Army base, or, you know, moving to Tulsa, Oklahoma, or being involved with the ballet, that was the real 60s. That this whole thing of Haight-Ashbury, this wasn't the real 60s. This was just a very marginal thing. You know, when people who were involved in so-called counterculture talked about it as a counterculture, there's a reason. It was a reaction against a very powerful dominant culture of the 1960s, which was very conservative, both in I shouldn't say both, in terms of dress, in terms of music. You know, really big albums of the 60s. You mentioned My Fair Lady. Sound of Music was the biggest movie of the decade. John Wayne was the biggest movie star. Julie Andrews, the biggest movie star actress. The big TV shows, Gunsmoke, Rawhide, Have Gun, Will Travel, etc. You know, this was Mary Poppins was a gigantic hit. Fiddler on the Roof. This was not West Side Story. This was not, you know, a really, for the most part, a radical culture. But people don't have this image shows how powerful the image that's been created by Hollywood is, And what's interesting, too, as with Woodstock, if you really look into the true stories behind many of the people celebrated by Hollywood, like Malcolm X and Che Guevara and Ralph Nader and so forth, which each of whom is examined in my book, you find out they're totally different than what Hollywood movies would tell you.
How is that? Just be a little more particular on that.
Well, let's take the example of Malcolm X. You know, I talk about Gloria Steinem, I talk about Ralph Nader, and I give you the real story behind these people, which you won't get, unfortunately, from Hollywood and even from TV news or newspapers. But let's just take the example of Malcolm X. Almost everything you might think about him based on his movie and also to a large extent his book, his autobiography, which he wrote with Alex Haley, almost everything he claimed is false. He claimed that his father was killed by white supremacists. No, his father died in a streetcar accident. He claimed that he had been a criminal kingpin, tried to glamorize himself during the 40s and 50s. No, he was an almost completely unsuccessful criminal that most people in Harlem had never even heard of, who were involved in crime at the time. Mostly he supported himself when he wasn't in jail or prison through gay prostitution. He got involved with the black Muslims. He presented it later as though he left, in the movie Malcolm X presents as though he left the black Muslims because he was upset with the extent of their racial separatism. That's not true. He certainly became more open to white people at the end of his life, but he was basically a racial separatist even at the end of his life. And why did he leave the group? He left the group because he was appalled to discover the extent to which his mentor, the leader of the group, Elijah Muhammad, was carrying on in various sexual affairs, which he found really repellent. So his account, of, you know, the account that we get of why he left is false. The view of what his attitudes were is false. You know, this is someone who publicly made fun of John Kennedy's assassination, was made clear how happy he was about it. This was by no means a pacifist, certainly wasn't a Christian in either in any sense of that word. And who killed him? You wouldn't know from Hollywood movies that this was done almost certainly on the orders of Louis Farrakhan, an aide to Elijah Muhammad, who had called for his death and whose aides were convicted and proven in court to be the killers.
Finally, then, you say that radical factions hijacked the social movements of the 1960s. What do you mean?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is an example. You know, it's presented as though he were a civil rights leader, as Huey Newton and Stokely Carmichael are presented as civil rights leaders. To find out who they really were and how they were in no sense a continuation of the ideals of Martin Luther King Jr., you know, unfortunately, you have to read my book because it you're not going to get this story from Hollywood, but certainly they were not pacifists, they were not Christians. Martin Luther King Jr. was a believer in a colorblind society. He was a pacifist. He's leader, of course, of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He risked his life without ever using violence or advocating violence. He certainly was not a friend of Malcolm X. There's a famous picture of them shaking hands, but in fact it was staged. Malcolm X knew that Martin Luther King Jr. was at the Capitol, and he went up and he forced Malcolm X to Martin Luther King Jr. to shake hands with him with photographers present to create the picture, which is a very misleading picture. So he and others who were very radical and very pro-violence took over the civil rights movement and used the term civil rights leaders, even though they certainly weren't civil rights leaders in any sense that people before them would have understood. They weren't for colorblind society. They were for racial separatism and nationalism. And the same thing happened with feminism. And the so-called anti-war leaders, for the most part, in fact, overwhelmingly, were pro-communist. They weren't anti-war. They were pro-war. They were in favor of war by our enemies. You know, whether they were Maoists, of which some were, members of a group called the Progressive Labor Faction, or whether they were pro-Castro, as Tom Hayden and Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers and other people were part of this thing called the Revolutionary Youth Movement were. So this is a story that you're, and for that matter, the leaders of the Berkeley Free Speech Movement were communists who were pro-North Vietnamese.
We've only got about 30 seconds here. When we see the footage of students dancing in the mud at Woodstock on top of their vans, were those students typical of American students, American youth in the 1960s? About 30 seconds for a response.
Absolutely not. And unfortunately, the only way you're going to get this story, because I don't think you're going to see Hollywood movies about typical young people moving to the suburbs and starting families. I'm afraid I hope that people will read the book, and I hope they'll like it.
Jonathan
Leaf, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Happy to do it. Jonathan Leaf is a playwright and cultural critic in New York City. He's written about arts and culture for National Review, The Weekly Standard, and The New Criterion, and he's author of the new book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the 60s. Thank you for being our guest.
Thank you so much again.
Folks, you can find out more about the Politically Incorrect Guide to the 1960s under the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org. Click on demand. When we come back from this break, Terry Mattingly is going to join us. We're going to talk with him about several issues. The Roman Catholic Church, at least in the form of its bishops, have been pushing for universal health care as a matter of basic human rights for decades. They were way out ahead of anybody else on this. So why is it the Roman Catholic politicians, while pushing for universal health care, ignore the other ethical parts of the Roman Catholic mindset when it comes to these things like not funding abortion and not hastening someone's death at the end of life? We'll answer that question and others with Terry Mattingly of Scripps Howard News Service on the other side of the break. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Wednesday afternoon, August the 18th. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Help inform your fellow parishioners about Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Click promote and copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. We update this paragraph weekly. Go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org.
The leadership of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is proposing sweeping changes in structure and governance. These changes would further centralize power in the church's bureaucracy and decrease the voice of LCMS congregations and laity. Stay informed. Read the new broadcast transcripts on this subject. You'll find them at the top of the on-demand page at issuesetc.org. These transcripts are a must-read for every layperson and pastor in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Issuesetc.org. Click on demand.
No giggling allowed. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Catholic organizations and hospitals have a big influence on healthcare reform, in large part because of their vested interest. But some groups like Catholic Charities USA is drawing criticism for their early support of Mr. Obama's plan that includes funding of abortion and rationing. The group says they don't support anything that includes abortion, but a recent revelation muddied the waters. Catholic Charities just announced they've received a government contract, their first ever, for $100 million. Critics wonder about the group's ties to the Obama administration, since they're playing a central role in getting Catholic organizations to support immediate health care reform, despite it including abortion and rationing. It may be another case of follow the money trail.
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.